Show Me the Way, Episode 40, the M&A CPA. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a real exciting show coming up with the transformational CPA, Linda Freeman. She's going to talk to you not only about the details and some of the intricacies of tax law that she deals with, but also at a very strategic level, which is why I call her transformational. And I think it's one thing, again, that we always have to remember. All professionals have a certain trade pedigree, specialty, and they're very detailed in what they do. But at the same time, some of them can really bring forth some really high-level strategic thinking about the process of M&A business succession planning and business continuity planning. Linda Freeman's bringing that to the table. Hope you listen to our podcast upcoming. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain, LLP, about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I am your host, Dave Sider. Hey, joining me today is Linda Freeman, CPA with Marks Nelson. This is a real world discussion because Linda and I have worked on mergers and acquisitions over the year. The good news is Linda will be sharing her observations and secrets in her role as an accounting professional, assisting all types of business owners with not only acquisitions, but growing their business and succession planning. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me today.
This is going to be good. With each show, I'd like to get a little background on the speaker so people can identify. So tell us, where were you born? Don't have to go into the years.
Oh, good.
Just where?
Thank you. I was like, wait a second. We just had anti-harassment training. You can't ask me that.
That's correct.
I actually was born in Ohio, and I love to share that the town is called Defiance, Ohio, because
yes.
Anybody who knows my personality, it just kind of fits. I tend to not necessarily follow all the right rules. But my family moved around a lot. So my dad's job moved us. He tended to work for a franchise operation. So we were a little bit like military brats from what I understand. So about every 2.5 years, we moved around. So we were Ohio, several places, Michigan, Texas, and moved to Kansas about the time that the business changed its model. And that's what I call home. I've been here the longest. So it's worked out really well. When I finished high school at Olathe, at the time, it was a small enough town. It was one high school. I left and went to Emporia State. And it was a really good experience. It was a small enough school that you knew that you could have a good time. You could get a good education. But it was small enough that the professors had their eye on you. And if you were having a little bit too much fun and, you know, showing up and not communicating during class, they would call you out on it. So you felt like you had a little bit of a safety net, and they just had a really strong couple of accounting professors at the time who did a really good job of getting you prepared for the exam and getting you prepared for real life, you know, what the accounting industry at the time was all about.
Wow, I had no idea. Number one, now I know why we get along so well, because I've lived in 7 different cities growing up. So we're both transients.
Yeah, it teaches you how to jump in.
Yeah. I mean, you just figure it out and then you move on down. So you are a CPA, you get out of college, the partying stops because everyone knows once you become a CPA, it's 24/7, 365. So you matriculated back to Kansas City or?
Yeah, I left Emporia. I actually started in Wichita, Kansas. At the time I started, it was a firm that became part of Grant Thornton. And it was a good experience. So, you know, good size firm, good background. I actually started in the audit side.
Whoa.
And was fortunate enough. I was doing fine in that area, but was fortunate enough that a lot of the audits I worked on tended to be real estate related. And this will age me a little bit when the 1986 tax act.
I remember it well.
When passive losses became a thing. We were the only auditors in our group and in our firm that knew anything about taxes because it just got to the real estate. So we were exposed to that in a different way than auditors typically were. And I found out very quickly, it was like the light bulb moment. I did fine at audits. I was progressing in my career, but I immediately, you know, switched over to the tax area. It was just a different model. It was quicker turnaround on projects. It was that constant being thrown a curve with new regulations, learning that you were constantly being that student. You really were immersed in the law. I like to think that if I had done it differently, I probably would have started more in law school and still gone to a tax bent. But it was a good experience. I landed at the right time, you know, when that was happening. And I've just really grown in the tax area ever since.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you that I don't want to get her in trouble with the AICPA or her firm or her practice, but she understands the law. It's all good. You didn't need a law degree, needless to say.
Well, I paid it a Holiday Inn.
So what initially got you into accounting at Emporia State? Was it a background? Was it a class that just kind of clicked? Are you good at math? Or what was it?
It's really funny to think about this too, because I will credit a high school teacher for getting me into accounting, only not because he encouraged me to. So I won't name his name. He meant well, but I remember very distinctly being in an accounting class. Mm-hmm. He was a lot more bookkeeping based, probably, I'm sure. But I remember getting some tests handed out to the students. And as he handed me my test, and it was a really good grade, and he didn't really say anything. He handed the test to the next student, who was a gentleman sitting next to me, who had a lower test score, but the high school teacher really commenting to him, like, you know, you could do really well in accounting. It's a great field, blah, blah. And he continued to move on. And it was like my first kind of sense of reality of, well, wait a second. I could do this too. So you kind of, I explored it further because it hit me. I was doing okay in it. You know, it was like, coming naturally. And then the more I kind of looked at it as a college choice, or, you know, my career choices in college, I realized, you know, there's a lot of cool things about it. It was, you know, you go into public accounting, it's portable. You could move wherever you wanted to. There was a demand that, you know, was obviously in the 80s. I already said that. You did not want for a job. And that wasn't every college kid coming out of school at the time.
Right.
You knew you could progress, and not to be gender, you know, specific, but it was a field that women were really beginning to become a noticeable number in. You really felt like there was a lot of fairness in a lot of the firms that were out there. They were employing females in a different way. They were giving them leadership roles, and you were starting to see clients who maybe had never worked with females before in those roles, being very accepting of it. Some of my best experiences have been coming alongside some very gruff, old-fashioned type clients who just were really great mentors.
That's neat.
Yeah.
That's really neat. So you didn't go down to the principal's office and call HR?
No. No, I kind of took it as a quiet challenge in my
head. Well, I was going to say that. Yeah. That shows the competitive side of you. I mean, that's really great, honestly. You didn't shrink with it. God, good for you.
And it's a funny one because I remember my parents, my siblings, there were quite a few, and they were all, you know, starting in college, changing major. It cost my parents a few extra years of schooling for a few of them. And my experience was, nope, this is it. Started in accounting, landed in accounting, you know, pursued it the whole way. And so they were pretty grateful for that little mishap.
So in your current position, share with the folks what you typically do for customers and clients before we shift into M&As.
Since I am, you know, purely tax, I tend to focus more on that compliance side. We have a tax group here that's unique and does some things that are for a special industry. My background tends to be pretty heavily in the manufacturing and distributing area with the high net worth individuals. And then with a lot of things that are related to that, you know, so with that manufacturing, distributing, you've got a lot of closely held companies. You have a lot of families. You might have their family office, some self rentals, shareholder returns, a lot of planning, a lot of estate and trust work. So tend to see a lot of that. And I think that's why logically a lot of the M&A has occurred.
So you've been involved in business continuity planning, helping people as they transition their business, maybe to generations. Let's talk about M&As then. You've been involved. Why do people bring in, let's start with, why do they bring in a CPA in regard to M&As just generally? What are your thoughts?
You know, it's interesting. I really feel like it's shifted. A few years ago, it was a lot of the family wealth being passed on, you know, bringing their kids up, training them in the business. And in the last couple of years, and especially this last year, there's just been so much more corporate activity. I think there's generational shifts and families are not experiencing, they've got kids who don't want to take over the business. There's a different world out there and corporations are recognizing there might be a way to create some efficiencies and pull these groups together through private equity. So we're seeing a shift from really focusing on that family group, although we still have quite a bit of that, to working with groups who have had just great successful businesses and they've got some wonderful opportunities. See, they're getting phone calls and seeing how we can help, you know, turn that into their retirement for them.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I've had this belief that over the last, really since COVID, okay, there's been a shift, you know.
Yes.
Not a shift in the force. I'm not a Star Wars, but you know, it seemed like from about 2014 to about 2020, in that time period, lots of money doing any deals. People were getting involved because there's so much money being offered and they're kind of thinking about making the jump. Since COVID, I don't know if there's been an awakening of people who say, like, you know, wow, that COVID really caused me to slow down and reflect and all of a sudden accelerate making decisions. And I don't know if it's because of, you know, mortality. I don't know if it's because it was just a shock to the business system.
I agree. You know,
I honestly don't know. And people have said recently, the M&A market has slowed down. I haven't seen it slow down or business continuity planning.
Ours has totally picked up. And I agree with you. I feel like, you know, part of it is what we're all starting to see. You've got a baby boomer generation that has been worked and they are starting to recognize, you know, maybe it's their turn to take a break. And I think COVID and a kind of a shrinking workforce has made some of them go, I've done this and I've given it my all, but they're tired of the compliance. And so being able to turn that over to especially a big corporate buyer, it makes them feel like, well, there's still a continuity in this baby that I gave birth to, but they are getting to step away from a lot of that daily grind. And they feel like that big corporate structure can to fulfill that need without jeopardizing these employees, you know, long-term trajectory as well.
That is very insightful. You've just proven that you're more than a tactician. You are strategic. I mean, I think you're spot on. I think it's what's happened is people have gotten worn down and they're going, do I want to ramp this up and make another run at it? Please don't quote me on this, but I thought I read somewhere at one time between now and 2050 or sometimes in there, there's going to be like $35 trillion changing hand or $53 trillion. It's just it keeps, you know, changing. That of all the baby boomers that are going out. The other thing that I found interesting along the same lines is that we have to remember as the baby boomers sellers are going out, the baby boomer buyers are also going out. And there's a suggestion by 2030, there may be fewer and fewer buyers.
That's a really good point.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. That's just kind of interesting because, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to have this mass migration to everybody looking to the exit door. I don't know.
Well, and I know even, you know, say here in Kansas City, when you've got a situation where a lot of companies have done great for years, good growth, but you've kind of saturated your Kansas City market. It's the biggest market in the world. And so the only way to keep going is you've got to find a way to tap into this more nationally and in comes private equity.
Very, very insightful. How do you get this global view? You must be reading things beyond just the code, needless to say. I agree with you. I'm impressed.
You're probably in the same boat. And I will tell you, over the last, 5-6 years, I think people thought, Kansas City, Midwest, small time. we've been really amazed at how all of our clients, a lot of clients that you would consider fairly small, have had more, you know, global exposure, international services that do reach out, you know, across the, which is a plus and a minus from a client standpoint. That's great. It taps them into all these markets. You know, they've got remote employees now. We stay very heavily now into the state and local area. And again, there's a compliance nightmare for you if you're a business owner. But you see that with a number of Kansas City-based companies.
I agree with you. So is there a typical time when someone reaches out to you? I'll answer it this question after I ask you. When do they typically reach out to you and say, hey, we're going to do an M&A or, you know, we're looking at a trend. When do you get contacted typically?
Let's just say the ideal client is going to call you before they sign up.
Exactly. And guess what? Ain't happening, folks. I'm telling you.
No, as it always, you know, some of the smaller ones might be a little less sophisticated and they don't understand how far down that path they've already gone. A lot of clients, though, they've toyed with this a few times.
Right.
So they've learned, you know, hey, don't sign anything before you start that conversation, even though everything can be negotiated and it's a long haul. The best time is for people, the best time is before they even have a buyer.
Right.
When they consider the fact, when they start going, wait a minute, I am 68 and I did think I was going to retire at 70 and I haven't even planned that. We have a group here who deals even with that pre-merger and acquisition, that succession planning. And that's the best time to be thinking about.
Absolutely.
How can you make your business even more attractive to that buyer? What changes can you make now so that they're looking at that continuity of a successful firm, a successful company that they want to buy, instead of only looking at the one good year and you've got to normalize and justify, and it can impact those negotiations.
Very insightful. So what you've been contacted, how do you then typically handle an engagement? What does it look like from your vantage point? And again, you're on the tax side. There's a whole nother issue of compliance, audit, but from a tax side, because as I say to clients, there's three important parts, I think, to any type of transaction: cash flow and tax, and law comes in somewhere after that. But I know if we don't deal with the first two, the third one ain't happening, so to speak.
I think what we've seen after lots of different transactions like this, it kind of averages out into a process where, if you're fortunate, the first real conversations are really all about what attracted the client to this. What's their hot button? Is this going to solve that hot button? And then going, if that's the case, what is it that they think they're getting out of it? Because a lot of times that dollar amount can sound attractive and they think it is solving their hot button, but they haven't considered all of the things that are going to happen.
Yes.
Is there debt in the company that has to be paid off? What's that income tax hit? You know, how can you structure that whole transaction so that the tax hit could be minimized? And the end of it, does it still give them what they hoped for, whether it was a net dollar amount or whether it was being able to step away? Because some transactions might give them one thing or the other. I got a lot of money, but I'm still tied to this for 5 more years, and that's not where I wanted to be. Because we all know, if you're an entrepreneur, and that is the company that you put your heart and soul into and built from the ground up, working for somebody else after you sell can be a real challenge.
I have not seen anyone really successfully navigate that if you're a true entrepreneur.
Yeah,
nobody's fault, but I think if you're a business owner, you really can't be anybody else's employee. A general rule, maybe 51-49% of the time. So how long in your involvement, how long have you seen over the years that it takes to come from beginning to end, that takes to complete an M&A? Is there any kind of parameters? Because I get asked that a lot. How long should it take, Dave?
Yeah, it's a good question. You've seen a lot of them are going to be easily 6 months.
Right.
9 months is not uncommon at all, depending on the size of the deal or how many different separate entities are, you know, being rolled into this. I've seen it even go on for a year. But the driver seems to be, if you've got a buyer who has done this before, they've got a good plan.
Yes.
They're coming in with a team. They've got a great checklist. They're very upfront about timing, and they've got a team that's really good about trying to hold everybody accountable to that calendar. And if the seller really does reach out to their advisors and they're not afraid to, you know, get into the weeds with their accountant and their lawyer from the get-go, it can happen in 3 months, you know, if already had a meeting at the mine. So it really depends. I think the key, though, is whatever amount of time it takes. I'm curious if you have found this. You can try to brace people for what this process is like. And I don't know that they ever really understand it. Even with great advisors and even with a great buyer, and if the buyer has a great team, I honestly think the closest thing you compare it to is a financial colonoscopy.
No, you're right.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of prep. And it just feels pretty uncomfortable at times, like, wow, they are really digging into some small, you know, ideals here. But yeah, it's a tough one. You got to be braced for it.
I will send you $10. I would like to use that term from now on. What I usually tell people, in fact, the last podcast I had was, I don't know if you know her, Dr. Michelle Robin over at Your Wellness Connection. I had a whole podcast on deal fatigue is what I call it.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, you know, just some point you get worn out. And I'm banking that away to share with clients because I think it's one of those things in life. If you've not been through it before, you have no idea, you know, and so you try to walk them through the process to the extent that they're open, want to know, but get ready for, you know, everything that they do where you're just exhausted and tired out from all the questions.
Absolutely.
And nobody escapes that. Even people like you and I mean, we get exhausted by the whole thing, but it's just part of the game.
You know, you've seen it too. We've seen some really good deals. People have walked away from very close to the end.
Yeah.
They just get disenchanted, and it's that fatigue, and it's a shame because they've already put 90% of the work into it.
Mm-hmm. And so here's one I will share with you. I'll refer you to Michelle's podcast. She had two ideas for me that I'm keeping. One is start out with somebody at the beginning of the venture. You know, I think it depends on whether it's a man or a woman. She used the analogy of a plant. Okay. Uh-huh. She said, think of yourself as a plant. You need to nurture and take care of yourself through this process. With men, I'm going to use a classic automobile. You know, if you want this old girl to run, okay, let's take care of her through the process. The other thing that she said is, you know, it's like while you're in the middle of it, it is literally like a family trip. Okay. You're in the station wagon circa 1960.
Yep.
The kids are in the back seat. They're yelling and screaming. The AC is out. You don't know where you're going. There is no GPS. You're not on any map. All the Holiday Inns are closed. I mean, and she's spot on. It was brilliant.
Yeah, it is.
So a couple of ideas. There's kind of a sharing there, but I like the financial colonoscopy. That's good. What happens, and I'm not going to say I'm God's gift to law, but what happens when you run up against people on the other side and they possibly have never done an M&A before? How do you handle it? Because I'm sure we've all been through that.
Yeah, I would say there have been a few that have been less sophisticated, and it's shocking because it kind of takes you a minute. You almost go into it assuming they know what they're doing and they've been there before. And I'd be curious to see, what you have found on the law side, on the tax side. Mm-hmm. Have you definitely seen some things where it's costly, and you have to recognize it and not be afraid to tactfully bring it up and to make sure, you know, your client, you know, dealing with the seller, that they understand.
Mm-hmm.
This could jeopardize things because you're probably structuring this to have some earnout, to have some contingency. And if they don't take this ball and run with it correctly, it's going to cost you. And so to not be afraid to bring those things up. And I've seen it a lot in the compliance area with those smaller purchases where it's been, maybe they didn't understand the licensing issue, the state jurisdiction fight, you know, the filings, they need to get payroll set up on their own. If they truly didn't designate in their own heads from the get-go that this was a stock type of a purchase or were buying assets, they will go into it incorrectly and not be set up so that the minute that ink is put on paper, that buyer can take that business and work with it the very next day. If they don't have it all in place and don't understand it, it's too late to get that set up at the last minute. So we've seen some stumbles with some of those smaller strategic purchases, and you get in there pretty quickly and make sure that you try to offer it up. I know it's a conflict, but hey, if you don't have the structure to do it, we'll give you somebody here to keep that moving, because you have to be able to stay in operations.
Well, and to your point, from my vantage point where I've seen folks that it may be new for them. And a lot of times, especially if I'm on the buy side, the seller might be using his friend who's an attorney, has done everything, especially on a smaller deal. And so it's one of those things where I am an advocate for my client, but I need to collaborate to get the deal done.
Yeah.
So I start lining out options with the client up front first, and then say, here's how I think we need to handle it on the other side. That can allow people to take advantage of the circumstances. And you might have to change, your tactfulness anyway, but it makes it more difficult. I think you and I, find if we can have people on the other side who've done this before, it makes the whole process manageable. I'm not going to say easier,
right,
but manageable.
Yeah.
Do you often find yourself in a situation where when you're at the beginning, you're going to bring in, when they say they're going to sell, you're going to bring in somebody to do some estate planning. You're going to bring in someone to do valuation. You're going to bring in somebody to do cash flow. You know, other folks of your firm that you're going like, I'm not sure these guys have looked into these things. How do we handle that? Or is that less frequent than I might think?
It's fortunately a little less frequent, and maybe that's because we offer those services. So we're really in clients' space a lot, offering that up, even if it's not sale time, whether it's for planning, whether it's to make sure that they do know that, do you know what your company is worth, so that when you do get those calls, it's kind of like being pre-qualified for that home purchase.
Bingo.
You hit the ground running. But I think sometimes there is, with some clients, and it doesn't even really depend on the dollar amount of the deal. Some very small deals, they're totally fine, but some very large deals, they can tend to be a little frugal.
Right.
And that can be a barrier for them. If they're not willing to bring in some of those services pretty quickly, you can spend a lot of time then working through a deal, only too late to find out, oh, wait, there's that much of a gain on this. What in taxes? Well, I want the net X. Well, just because you want to net that doesn't mean that the buyer is going to gross that up by the tax. So it's interesting. That it's an interesting question. We've been pretty fortunate because we do operate in that area a lot already.
And I think it's back to your point. You really like to get involved and help craft the LOI. I was just talking to somebody today that we're getting pretty close. I said, please just bring me in, not to negotiate it if that's not what you want me to do, but just talk about some of the issues and concepts and things that maybe you want to have there, an ounce of prevention is a pound of cure, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, to your point, the LOI isn't the contract. We all know that.
Yeah.
But it's such a great communication tool. And if you've lined out the hot buttons on both sides, the deal breakers, the reasons that you would walk away, and you guys are still talking, then that's a successful LOI. But it doesn't just happen because the buyer hands you their boilerplate and then you start from there. It's kind of hard to go back and think those topics when they've started down that path.
And see, this is why you want to hire somebody like Linda, because she's telling you not only the technical terms, but also the big picture, the strategic thought process you want to have going through this, which obviously this is not your first rodeo, as we say in this part of the country. You've done this quite a bit. That's really great insight. Are there any successes that you've seen over the years that you're going like, wow, that was really a great way of doing it? Obviously, we're not going to release the name so we can protect the innocents, but any kind of deals that you saw that you went like, wow, that was really great. And here's the lesson I learned. It's really about the lesson, I think.
There have been some really good ones. One I can think of that was just so complex in size that it was that rare textbook moment. Really get into the weeds of tax code that you don't normally get to see. So that was a success from that standpoint. I will tell you another one that I found incredibly successful was witnessing the buyer's team, the communication all the way up the channel from some of the associates who were silent on the calls. You thought they really weren't producing anything, but they were circling back later with follow-up and holding people accountable. And their communication being so, really talented in their ability. You could tell they'd done this multiple times so that they could help that buyer get through that process, get to the finish line without them feeling put out, really making it a team effort. And that was a really big success I found. I learned a lot from launching their communications. And I will tell you, one of my biggest successes, I think, was one, a client deal that was a very significant one that they backed out of.
And it was
the right move. And it very much was, it was a good lesson in, again, not being afraid to keep reminding the client. You seem to keep moving towards something that's not what you said at the beginning. Was it your goal? Have we changed things? And they knew it. They knew that. And they were very grateful to have stepped away from that. They were recognizing it kind of needed somebody to give them permission. It was a lot to walk away from, and it was the right thing for them. They had a really successful ride for years after before the right thing came along.
Isn't that interesting? I've had a couple, actually. Same thing, where I'm going like, you know, it's just not right. And it always turned out. I mean, if it's not right, it's not right. Don't force it.
And to your point, it was like you were starting to have to really nickel and dime some of the terms. And you went, you know, it isn't about the money. There's a culture.
Yep.
Cultural fit doesn't feel like it's what you guys have said you wanted to step into, because there was going to be some continuity after the deal. And that just seemed like it was going to be World War III if those two companies got together.
So now the new word for you is not only strategic and tactical, but transitional or transformational. That's it. Because you see the whole process. And again, I think there's nothing deficient with anybody in either one of our professions. They see it from a very narrow window. Mm-hmm. But somebody like you that can see not only the specifics and the details, but the big, broader picture, that's rare. So good for you. I mean, that's something important. I think you want in a professional that can see the little itty bitty points, but where are we going on this mission, Custer? I don't think this is the right place. Little Bighorn is not the answer to our problems.
Yeah. And you've probably found that too, that there isn't one size fits all.
No.
You know, putting together a deal, none of these agreements are the same. I think sometimes people can go into it almost like a tax return. Well, there's going to be one right answer, right? Well, not necessarily. And I think that's where, you know, you've probably enjoyed things, being able to put this puzzle together, but there's no edge piece.
Yeah.
So you can make it your own every single time.
It's fun, I think, from a professional standpoint, not so much for the client, but, you know, it keeps people like you and me going. What are some of the disappointments that you have, and what were the lessons that you learned? And my theory is, when I say that, I always have to back up and say, I don't believe people fail. I believe certain behaviors and actions fail. They just don't work, you know, and you learn from that. And I don't think you learn from success. I think you learn from failure.
That's true. And, you know, again, every one of these deals is going to be different, because with every passing year, you know, there could be new tax law that impacts that transaction different than another one. And I think it really does get down to, if there's ever a less than stellar feeling, it really does boil down to just that communication piece. If the client is reluctant for any reason to really engage people to their fullest, you feel at the end like you didn't really get a chance to uncover all the things that might come up for them, to really protect them, to really be their advocate. Fortunately, you kind of hope that maybe they won't run into some of those issues, but, you know, 9 times out of 10, a year down the road, they realize, oh, what? I don't get X out of the deal. You know, they don't think about it until that escrow is being released or that contingency is calculated. And it's like, well, you know, if you're not going to invest the time to explore what those things will look like someday. So I think those are probably where I would say they haven't been failures, but it's a client's choice and you honor it. But it can be a little short-sighted.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that. So if you were to give three pieces of advice, your top three, what would it be to anyone going through this process?
Top three. I don't know if I'll put them in the right order, but I do think the first one is recognizing what you want out of this deal.
Yes.
Writing that down, having that in front of you and following that throughout the whole process. Really paying attention to the cultural fit. Money doesn't solve all problems. And that third one truly being, you know, work with a team that you feel very comfortable communicating with. You know, it's like going to your doctor. You got to feel like you can tell them everything.
Yep.
The due diligence process is going to uncover things. You might find things that you never knew were incorrect, and now that's coming to light. But it's not a time to hold back on the things that you do know about. You want a team that you really feel like you talk well with. They hear you. They honor that. But they're going to bat for you. You know, they're standing in front of the line, taking the bullets from the other side. Not that it's always going to be a battle like that, but that they're willing to still go and try to get you the best deal that they can, knowing all of the facts.
And at the end of the day, not every deal should be done.
Right.
So when you put it in that kind of a thought process anyway. Hey, kids, this has been good. I'm going to call her the transformational CPA. I think because she's gone much, much beyond just her pure knowledge of details. Very helpful. I've learned a couple of things today that I'm going to borrow from you, specifically the financial colonoscopy. That one,
there you go.
I'm going to have to just get on board with that. Let me ask a question. How do people get a hold of you if they want to know more?
Great question. So Marks Nelson, we're here practicing in, you know, a number of areas beyond mergers and acquisitions, tax compliance and planning, succession planning, audit, tech, a number of services that we can help provide. But you can always reach us through our website. You can reach me at 816-743-7700. Anytime, just give us a call and we'd like to explore. Hey, what are you even thinking about? And are we the right fit for you? And if not, I bet you that we'll know somebody who might be, but always looking for those opportunities to work alongside of you, Dave, because you're delightful. We've had that chance a number of times, and I hope that's going to continue.
It will. And you're just you are just a nice person to work with. And that's what people need to know. Thank you, Linda. And I want to tell our listeners that if you're in search of assistance, please go to davesider.com. Or to SpencerFain.com, look me up and schedule a consultation. Also, please make sure to subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Linda, thank you so much. And ladies and gentlemen, be safe. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice. It is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, business owners should consult with their attorney on their distinct circumstances.